Welcome to Dentology, the Business of Dentistry podcast. In this podcast, we delve into the non-clinical aspects of dentistry with inspirational guests from across the profession. You will hear incredible life stories, pick up valuable business tips, and be entertained. I'm Andy Acton, and I'm joined by my co-host, Chris Drevens.
I think quite often, the thing that we often get from guests is insights, isn't it? It's their perspective on a profession that we know so well, we work in, but those individual insights are so powerful.
Just a different view, isn't it, sometimes? And I think it's interesting where I love the fact of when we talk to guests, we engage at different levels, at different places than our guests do. So therefore, that is where those different insights come from.
Yeah.
And also, I think that the great thing with Lucy was that that variety and that story she tells about, sort of almost like a big journalistic scoop, and you'll have to listen to find out what that was. That sort of quite an interesting sort of fast-paced, all that sort of adrenaline junkie stuff. Brilliant, really
But
brilliant.
Also talking about how, and we all do it, we all obsess about marketing, getting new clients, but actually the obsession should really be around loyalty. And making sure that the people you have within your universe, you're really looking after.
What's brilliant is it just reinforces what we say when Frank Taylor does those valuations, that people know how many patients, new patients, but have absolutely no idea how many patients they've lost. And they're a valuable income source.
How big is that hole in the bottom of the bucket?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. No, a real good one.
Well, if you're a first-time listener, you're very welcome. And thank you for joining us. If you listened before, here's another great episode for you. If you could subscribe, that would be great because it just helps us in terms of our rankings and exposure. And if there's anyone you know who would like to listen to Dentology, please share this podcast with them. That'd be amazing.
Thanks very much.
So another episode coming our way, sir.
Indeed, another Dentology podcast. Exactly. The business of dentistry.
Yeah.
Those people just sit there. You can anticipation with people out walking or driving their cars. What is it going to be this week?
Well, this week we have a very, very special guest.
And dun, 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 dun.
We do. This week,
no pressure.
Lucy Simic joining us. And Lucy is a dental consultant and speaker in the world of dentistry. So welcome, Lucy. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm really well. Thank you very much. Thank you so much for having me on. Really exciting.
Not at all, not at all. We're very much looking forward to it,
actually. Yeah, find out more about you.
Yeah.
We were saying before we started recording that kind of Dentology, our podcast channel, is the business of dentistry. And whilst it's great having dentists on, we were saying how dentistry as a profession, as a community, requires so many people to support it for the dentist to provide excellent patient care. And the things we'll be talking today about fit into that really nicely because it is a large community and we talk about it being kind of an ecosystem and there's so much support that's needed for them to thrive. So it'd be really good to have that conversation. Let's just wind back to the very beginning. I think our childhood often leaves breadcrumbs as to the people we become in the future. So what was your childhood like? Where were you brought up? What was that like?
So I am one of those people who has never really settled any particular place until the last kind of decade or so of my life. I've kind of always been this wanderer, I guess, and that comes from my dad. So he is, strangely enough, a maxillofacial surgeon, and he was somebody who was really ambitious in life. He loved, and I mean literally loved, his job. Still does it part-time now, but he loved what he did. And I think that just filled me up from the very beginning in do something that you love. It sounds really cheesy, but it's never been truer as something that I am and do. And I think when I look back through kind of childhood and career, it has always stuck with me because I've kind of changed or taken a path. I have very much had that sliding doors life, forever reinventing, forever kind of challenging myself, moving on, changing, doing something slightly different. And I think it comes from him saying to me, you have to do something that you love so that you get up every day and want to go to work.
Great advice.
I watched that in him. So he was a dentist when he qualified dentistry first, but never worked in practice, always worked in the hospital. And he met my mum in hospital. She's a theatre nurse. So we are that medical family.
Ah, look at that.
Home.
And then dab his brow, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And then he decided he wanted to see out the dream of being a maxillofacial surgeon. And so once my sister and I were born and we were very young, he went back to university. And so I actually watched my dad study for his medical degree. All the while, my mum was working nights. So she was a theatre nurse working nights at a hospital in Cardiff whilst my dad was at university during the day so that somebody could be home with us. I saw them sacrifice things in order to achieve. And it was wonderful. We went to his graduation. There's a really cheesy photo of my sister and I in matching outfits with a boater because it was the early 90s and that's what your mum did.
lovely.
And so he did that with the support of the Royal Air Force, which he joined. So he joined the Royal Air Force for them to be able to support
him.
Which is how the travelling came about.
I was going to ask about that. So that's right.
Yeah. So that was how we moved. We were in different places around the UK. There was a stint in Hong Kong. So we travelled a lot. Mm. And we set up. It's one of the reasons I love a good declutter. And every so often, I think a house move is really good for the mental health, just to kind of clear the decks and get on. So that's very much, I've never really had home. I've never really been centered. Certainly in childhood, there wasn't home. There was, houses that we lived in, but no home.
What was that like for schools and stuff like that? Because you must have to keep starting again.
So yes, you do, or you would. But the kind of twist in it was that my parents sent us to a boarding school. So I went to school just outside Bath. It was a school in Wiltshire, and look out, privileged upbringing, here we come. But it was an equestrian school.
Cheltenham's Lady College.
That was it. That was a local school. But I took my pony to school with me. That's how privileged I was. So I had the...
There's nothing to be wrong. There's nothing to be wrong about that, I tell you. I think people feel a bit funny about it. And I think that's just the way your upbringing was. Do you know what I mean? It's just the way you were.
I was really fortunate. My mum and dad worked really hard for what they had. I watched them work hard for it. And it didn't come easy. It wasn't, it wasn't just, I mean, I went to school with some people who had, extreme wealth. Mm. And it wasn't that. It was working hard for what you had. And I think I look back now and recognised the privileged position. At the time, you don't, and you kind of take it for granted. It certainly was something that, again, created the person I am today. I am very independent as a result of that experience.
You don't buy your exams, do you? You know, it's that thing is the fact of whilst you might have the circumstances, I think sometimes people get very funny about where people are brought up or where they come from, but actually it's the individual and you still have to work hard. It's not like just because you can bring your pony to school, well, guess what, we'll give you an A star or whatever it was. It doesn't work like that.
No, it doesn't. You still have to, do those things. And I think actually the bit that was hidden that I probably didn't really recognise was I got up every morning from the age of, I went to boarding school before I was 10, and I went until I was 16. And every single morning when I was at school, I would get up and I would go and look after the pony before I started my school day. So I would get up at 6 o'clock and I'd be on the yard. We'd be mucking out. We'd pull together. It would be a team effort because there were rules and there were things you had to do. Not only did your pony have to be mucked out and looked after, but the yard had to be spick and span. And only when you had, they used to kind of patrol it afterwards. They would do a quick kind of check that everything was done. And then you could leave. You could go back, you could shower, then you went to breakfast, and then you went to school. And then after school, you went back and you did the same thing again before you had dinner and you did your homework. And so there was a huge amount of routine and discipline.
That character was building, I think, is what we would say, character building. Do you still ride now, or is it not something
I don't.
You do?
So, I gave it up at just before I turned 18. I think boys made an appearance on the scene. And it was very kind of like, do I want to continue spending my time traveling around the country competing on ponies, or do I fancy something different? And I picked a different life. I think I also recognised it wasn't necessarily serving me. I wasn't going to make a career out of it. So, I moved on to other things.
Do you have family? Do you have children?
I do. I have two boys, and they have both ridden. They don't, yeah, don't have horses, but yeah, I think if I had girls, it might be a little bit different.
Yeah, yeah, I was going to say, I'll be interested. I was wondering whether, you know, if you've got children and they want to ride, yeah, then you'll be like, oh, yeah, mum might have a little go.
No, I very definitely look and think if it had been at kind of the roles reversed. I sort of think that my having two boys, which is exactly what my husband grew up with, two boys, is like some kind of karmic retribution for happiness that was, yeah, that. So my, yeah, dad with his wife, yeah, and my mum and my sister, he was in a very girly dominated environment. Yep. Mm. So I am now watching all the football that he couldn't watch because he lived in a house of girls. That's how I see it.
Excellent.
So when you were at school, you got inspired on a school speech day. You, yeah, had a journalist, the journalist of the era with her pearl earrings, Kate Hady, came down and gave a talk at school.
Yeah, I mean, this gives away my age to some degree, doesn't it? But she was just my ultimate idol. By this point, I had identified the fact that I wanted to be a journalist. Hmm. And I was chosen as head girl at school. And for that, we always had an end of year speech day is what they would call it. And there'd be prizes and lovely things. And they always had a guest speaker. And the year that I was head girl, Kate Ady was our guest speaker. And this poor woman must have thought, who is this child? Because I'm like, don't leave. I'd watched her. I had seen her she was the first woman, I guess, out there for me, mm, on a screen that, mm, was showing me that it didn't have to be male, that there, mm, could be something else. And I think she gave me something to aspire to. You know, they say, don't they, see it, do it, be it, you know, that mm, thing. And she absolutely was that to me. She was the person I looked at and thought I'd like to be doing.
And in dangerous circumstances.
Oh, yeah. You know,
it's not like she was, yeah, doing a weather or something.
I think she was one of the. I think she's one of the first frontline reporters to the Iranian embassy, wasn't she?
Yeah, and she wrote a book, and I just to this day, I wish, you know, I could go back and say to her, I genuinely, you have inspired me. Mm. You inspired me to do, you know, what I did and the course of my kind of life. And she still inspires me to say, you can put yourself out there.
Did you read her book?
Yeah.
Because that was the only reference to you.
No, I really wish you'd be a child.
That's all I was thinking. Was that and then there was this really irritating girl.
Yeah, she just wouldn't shut up.
But it wasn't just inspiring. It actually led you to your career choice before doing what you do in dentistry, because you were a broadcast and newspaper journalist.
Yeah. So I called it. I despite growing up in a medical household, I quite quickly thought, this isn't for me, it's not what I want. I wasn't very good with bodily fluids, so I'm not sure that a medical background was necessarily the one for me. So I kind of looked at it and went, yeah, I don't think so. And so from a really quite young age, I said, I'd like to be a journalist. That's what I would like. And my mum and dad...
Were your mum and dad supportive?
Sorry. Yeah, really supportive. Mm. Like properly, I think, completely got it, saw what it could be. Mm. We went on holiday to New York, and in Times Square, they have Fox News, don't they, in the big glass box.
Yeah.
And I remember standing on the street and I said, I'm going to do that. That's going to be me. And it was just a thing I wanted. And I had, through school, done... at the time it was called speech and drama. I'm not sure if that's a thing anymore. But I used to do that. And obviously having been in Wales as well, I used to go and actually perform for kind of competitions.
Oh, wow.
Competitions, and you'd be judged and, you know, et cetera, on your presenting skills. So all of that kind of built me to who I was. Mm. And yeah, I went to university, and this was before media studies was cool. Mm. So we had to do English with communication. That was what they called
it. Oh, is that what it was called? English with communication. Right, okay.
Yeah. And so I studied that. And whilst I was at university, one of my tutors, my lecturers, was also worked at the BBC in Cardiff. And she was an amazing lady, again, formidable, female, strong character working in production for the BBC. And she offered me really kindly some work experience.
Oh, wow.
And as seems to be the case, I just get involved and they can't get rid of me. So that was it. I was stuck. And I started out in a newsroom for the entry-level job is called a researcher. So you are effectively the person who writes the stories, you find the stories, you determine, you know, with the rest of the production team, what you're going to make a highlight today or what you're not.
Right.
Or,
okay.
You know, all of that stuff. Then I'm booking guests and collecting guests and taking them into studio, prepping them. It's a really.
Did they suggest to you what the topic, or was part of your job also to suggest topics?
It was to suggest. So this was the interesting bit. Yeah, because actually when you get in, every morning starts with a production meeting and they literally go around the room where they go, who's got something? Who's got a story? What's happening? Mm. And as I'm sure you can imagine, there are slower news days where things, you know, and occasionally.
I think we've seen them when they appear on BBC.
Yeah, that was probably me.
Here we are, reporting on a hedgehog crossing a road.
Yeah.
That's what we had in Devon. It was, our tractor drove up the road the wrong way. But in Cardiff, it was much more kind of obviously metropolitan to a degree. Mm. And yeah,
that's great.
You would pitch your story and hope that, you know, you had something.
So what's this, you're 21, 22 here?
So I'm potentially, I graduated 2003. So yeah, I'm early 20s. Mm. 20.
I think that's brilliant, actually. I never really thought about it. But you get an early age to sort of influence what, I don't know, however many people watch, I don't know if it was BBC or BBC Wales or whatever, but you've still got, you know, millions of people tuning into a story that you have decided to champion or create. Do you know what I mean? That's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. And you would get it because people would contact you with their information.
Wow.
And sometimes it would be PR companies. Mm. Other times it would be people themselves. Sometimes you would be out and talking to somebody and they would tell you something and you'd think, that's interesting. We should think about that.
Makes you think of those films where someone goes, I've got a scoop for you.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. That's exactly what would happen. And then the most fascinating kind of moment, and this is where you realise things are so cyclical, but I was actually in the newsroom for the breakout of the Iraq war. So that was that moment. And the pulling down of Saddam Hussein's statue in Iraq. And outside of the UN headquarters, I don't know if you remember, there was a day where they bombed the UN headquarters there. And my job at that point in the newsroom, and I can't underestimate the adrenaline that's running through everybody. You know, there's this weird, almost psychopathic kind of moment where you forget the human level of what's happening.
Yeah.
And my job at that point was, we need to speak to somebody who either worked or works in that building, get me somebody. And so, you know, it's not quite, it was a little bit more computerized, but not much. But we've got this giant Rolodex and I'm going through all the contacts. And eventually I'm trying everybody. And as you can imagine, the chaos means that phones are dead or nobody's answering, quite rightly. And I dial one number and I get a guy on the ground. And he's quite literally outside the building, cowering behind a water fountain, a big fountain. Mm. And he said, I'm hiding. And I can hear the noise going on around him.
Wow.
And at this point, I had this really divided moment where I thought to myself, oh my God, I've got the catch of the century. Like, this is a chap who's on the floor. Yeah. He's just fled this building that's been bombed. This is massive. And then the other side of me is I'm talking to this guy and he's there almost kind
petrified.
Of
fearing for his life.
Fearing for his life. And I'm having to talk to him and go, I don't suppose you would possibly mind, would you? He was amazing. And he stayed there and we got onto Sky News. My contact, my phone call was the catalyst.
So did you sort of put them through or something? Is that how it works?
That is exactly it. So once you have got your lead, you've got your story. So once I've given him to the BBC and they've done what they want, we then buddy up and say, hey, do you want, do you need? And everybody's contacting us going, have you got this person? Yes, I do. Then I'll put you through. And all the while, I am the in-between girl. So he's on the phone for 3, 4, 5 hours with me and I'm just talking constantly.
Tucker.
Yeah, unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable.
It must be quite hard. You were just saying it. So that disengagement, in a way, because you have to disengage your feeling brain. I don't know if that's quite the way to look at it. You sort of have to. This is my job. This is my job. I can't think about what else goes around it.
I suppose it's almost like the excitement of the job takes over in that moment. It's not about people. It's about I've got an opportunity to deliver a message to the world.
And I think it's that there's a phrase, isn't there? Ambulance chasing. Mm. And I think obviously journalists have not had the best of times in terms of reputation wise recently and continue to, for whatever reasons. Yeah. And I can see why, I guess, because I sit across both sides of this argument and I go, we are in the moment, we forget what we are doing. And that's quite similar to dentistry, because I think sometimes dentists do the same. They forget that there's a human in that mouth.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think in that moment, we become all encompassed on, I've got a job to do and somebody is holding me to a higher level than human, if that makes sense.
There was a professor once, wasn't it? Someone told us, as a professor, I think it was a good few years ago, but he basically described a patient as a biological way of getting that mouth into your office. And he was like, oh, okay, that's not really looking at it as a patient, is it? No, and that was his thought.
Very honest,
it's a biological
method.
It's unbelievable.
And I think that's the point with the journalism. I think you get swept up in an environment that tells you, I want the story, I want this, I want that. And that's exactly what happens in a newsroom. Mm.
So now you work in dentistry on the non-clinical side. So what would you say were the transferable skills you learned from that world that are serving you well today?
So I genuinely to this day believe the biggest thing for me is the show businessness of it. So the thing where you, I went to work and I put on a performance, and I do that in dentistry as well, because it's about communicating and it's about controlling the controllables and being that.
Is it worth asking Lucy to tell us what actually you do?
Yeah.
I'm just thinking for people might, but well, I still don't know what you do. Just give us a sort of like a little snapshot of what you do, because then it might sort of fall into place a bit. Really.
Yeah. So I spent the first probably 8 years of dentistry. So I joined dentistry in about 2013, just about. I spent that time as a business manager, a practice manager, a general manager, whatever you want to call them, but the person who led the business. And I now subsequently have gone on and worked within corporate. I've done squat practices, private, NHS, you name it. I've done kind of most things now. But I no longer work in a single practice. I am working for myself, and I do a few things. So the first thing is I have a bespoke consultancy. I work one-to-one with practice managers and their business owners. I kind of talk about it as I want to help them better communicate with each other and their team. So it's sort of looking up and down the tree, if you like. And the other thing I do, or hope that I do, but I'm out there doing, is training and speaking. So I cannot tell you how passionately I love dentistry now that I'm in it. And I honestly believe, from the outside in, it's an industry that needs more highlighting to everybody else, kind of the regular world, because the opportunities that are endless. And for me, I'm a walking example of that. Someone who came in as a practice manager who then, you know, changed a little bit to this, moved into another practice, did something slightly different. And now I'm out there working with practice managers, working with their teams, working with front of house, working on customer service. I call it the more than dentistry part of it. So I sort of do everything but the dentistry. That's the book title that I'm going to pen.
You said that when you were a practice manager, you found that world quite lonely, and that may have perhaps influenced the support you give to practice managers now. Why was it a lonely world, and have things changed?
Yeah, so I think firstly, dentistry – a decade or so ago was very insular. I think even, you know, dentists would go and they would network, but the rest of the team didn't really do that. There was no real networking. There was no real communicating with anybody else. And it felt like we were these tiny islands kind of bobbing along doing our own thing. And I came in and I've worked in some bizarre environments, a newsroom being one. The second one was I was once a marketing manager for a Windows company. So I've worked with, you know, tradesmen, and I will call them tradesmen because the correlation is important, because that was a very male-dominated kind of labor-intensive job, slightly different to coming into a dental practice, which is very female, certainly in the, you know, the non-dentist kind of role as well. And so I came in and very quickly realized that I couldn't be their friend. I had to be their boss. And that meant that you got pressure from above and pressure from below. And you sat in this middle section. And actually, the dentist that I'd worked for, who was an incredibly inspiring leader, had said to me, "You can't sit with them. At lunchtime, you'll need to, you know, remove yourself from that situation, because sometimes you'll do things and say things that will mean they want to walk into the lunchroom and go, 'What a bitch.'" And they have to be able to do that. And
so, their space. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the rest of the practice has these sub teams. You know, you've got your front of house team, you've got your nurse team, you've got your TCO team, you've got your dental team, you've got your dental nurses, you've got so many teams. And then this manager just sat there. And I see why it became a job that was kind of synonymous with closing the door, if you get my drift. You know, there was a sense that practice managers would retreat. They would close the door and nobody really knew what they were doing. And I didn't want that to be the case. I knew I couldn't be their friend. And I knew there were certain things I had to do, but I also knew that I could communicate well with people. I knew that I wanted to lead them. And so I wanted it to be open door. And I worked in a practice that was fortunate enough to have a business hub on the, it didn't start out that way. But once we had grown and developed the business, we had this incredible open plan office space upstairs. And I didn't have an office. That was purposeful. So that I was out there and I would sit on the reception, and we were open 7 days a week. And that meant that I was there Saturdays and Sundays in the practice.
It's phenomenal, really. But it's an interesting sort of change, isn't it, to go from
and
to
also
then
really
sort of suddenly being in that females but male dominated dentist part.
And a great observation on your part, which perhaps came back from the previous work that you'd done in terms of working on that floor where everyone was available and it was very high octane, and you know it all happened in real time, to having these little compartments where it's like, you don't talk to these people, you do it this way. But from a kind of an open communication point of view, what the things you were seeing back then is now just the modern way of how we work. You know, good practices, good businesses have a very flat hierarchy. You can talk to anybody about anything and things move forward so much more quickly.
And I think that, you know, the more industries that you visit or you see or you're involved in, you recognize as well that the great ones are there showing the aspiration and the career path. And I think that's something that dentistry has been really poor at, and something I'm mega keen to change, because actually the problem for a lot of staff members, I think, in dental practices is they don't know what's available to them and what the next move might be. And so I think it's really important that we do show them. So I don't back away when I talk to teams from telling them my own career path, but also kind of what I do. Because I think sometimes, again, we get very, I don't want to let this person go. I don't want them to leave. I need them to stay. We take it very personally. You know, if somebody leaves, we think, blimey, what have we done? And often it's about flourishing. And we have seen more of that in the last, I think, you know, I'm not going to blame COVID, because I genuinely don't think it is COVID. I think what COVID did was microscope it so that it became something we saw a bit quicker. I think it sped it up. But we're losing people from dentistry because they don't know what opportunities there are in dentistry because we don't show them, because we're terrified of saying, go and find out about being an orthodontic therapist. Hey, dental nurse, go and find out about doing this. Hey, practice manager, did you know you don't have to be practice manager forever? It doesn't.
Maybe the why, I suppose, wasn't it? I remember we were saying, weren't we, you know, you're getting people during the COVID period, especially that when in our other life you see valuations of what people pay their staff. And then suddenly there was this realization that, hang on a minute, I could go and stack shelves in Sainsbury's for more money than I'm earning now. I will get then 20% off my food bill because maybe no one has made me realize how important and the value that I have in the team. Interesting.
Absolutely.
Lucy, how would you gauge the mood in dentistry at the moment? Because last year for lots of people was quite tricky.
Yeah.
Although, interestingly, during the year, not that many people
were
vocal about it.
It was great.
When everyone does their year-end wrap-up, I was surprised by how many people quite openly said, it's a really flipping hard year. What's your take on kind of last year and coming to this year?
I think two things. I think business-wise, we are still very buoyant. I think there are loads of opportunities for dentistry. I think I've got no concern over the financial ability to run a brilliant business in dentistry. The biggest problem that we have and will continue to have in dentistry is its people. And I think that feedback that you've had from 2023 is far more about them starting to feel the way the team has felt as well over the last couple of years. I think we feel tired. I think we're looking for, I hate the word balance because I don't think there is a work-life balance. I think we have to look at what's a priority in the time moment that we're in. And I don't think we're doing that well enough for our teams. And I think that makes it hard. So when we're losing good staff members and we're losing people out of dentistry, I think it puts pressure on the rest of the team. And they are then consequently seeing a way out. And you talked about, you know, somebody going to work for Aldi or Lidl. I was in Bristol last week in Cribbs Causeway, and they've got an Itsu restaurant, and there's a job advert in the window, and it said, come and work for Itsu. It is £12.90 for somebody who works in a restaurant, but you could be a shift leader and be earning £29,000. And then it listed all of the benefits, and then it said, and if you want progression and you want growth, here is what you could be if you became store manager. And it was £35,000. And two key things. Firstly, notice how they've jumped to an annual salary for those big hitting jobs. Hate hourly rate. Why we do this in dentistry drives me insane. It's such a backwards way of working. And as someone who's professional and worked in loads of different industries, why we do this, I'll never know.
It's so true, isn't it? Because it makes you look like a shelf stacker.
Yeah.
But also, I never really thought about it before, but you're right. If you're going to pay somebody hourly, why wouldn't they think beyond an hour?
Yeah. Absolutely.
If you want someone to think and commit to your practice, if you say, well, I'm going to value you on an hourly basis, why would somebody say, well, is this a career I could really settle into for the next few years?
I never thought about it, actually, the hourly rate thing. You're right,
And it's something that I've wondered about for so long and always changed. Whenever I've gone into a dental practice, that's the change I make. I say to them, we're moving to an annual salary and this is what it will be. Yes, for the first few months you convert for the team because they need to work out in their brain what it means. But eventually what you do is you start to build this culture that values the staff member and growth and what that looks like. And if I'm competing, because now I'm not competing with a shelf stacker, I don't want to compete with a shelf stacker. I want to compete with people who are in sales and big end hospitality, and they're being paid an annual salary. And I also think from a workforce point of view, everybody talks about it now, the purpose, the meaning, the why, giving some meaningfulness, otherwise motivation. And I think people look at it, and if you are working to an hourly rate, everything becomes that 8-hour day and nothing more. Whereas I've never gone into a job and thought that job starts at this time and finishes at that time. I'm in it. I'm in it 365 days a year. Like,
And it is about, I think it is, as you're saying, it's about giving purpose, isn't it? It's about saying to people, actually, you're important.
Mm.
And I think that it's quite interesting, your comment about the almost like a time lag in the fact of the princes have been having a great time. This is a generalisation, because they've done really well.
Yeah.
So business has gone really well. So they feel very buoyant about it.
Yeah.
But I wonder how buoyant in a lot of practices their staff felt about the business going very well. Because did they know it was happening? They do, because they see what's going on. But did they get any benefit from it? And then now there's almost like it's catching up a bit. It's fascinating.
There's a big disconnect between the practice being successful and your team, because we don't trickle the information down. We're not very good at that. And again, you know, something I've seen, I've watched, I've been in part of, and now I go in and I profess to this, you have to trickle that information through. They have to know what they're working to, what those targets are, and what success looks like, because success for one person is different to another. And when you're dealing with a front of house team member who's seeing sometimes thousands of pounds cross the PDQ on a daily basis, they can sit there and feel very detached from the ultimate game. And you and I both know that money comes in hard and fast to a dental practice, but it goes out as quickly.
Mm.
And the gap that we're looking at is minimal. But the front of house team don't know that. No. They have no clue, because we don't share with them that information.
Well, that's a bit like associates. It's a bit like associates, isn't it? Well, I can't believe that bloke takes 50% of mine.
Yeah.
And it's like, but hang on a minute. Have you realised that he's also provided a nurse for you and all the other bits and all this and that?
And lots of practices, we know, because we see lots of their numbers. They've done really well through the starting the back end of 20, but 21 and 22 in particular were good financial years. There was a spike in terms of spending on dentistry, and some of them hadn't incurred the costs in 20 that they might have. Have practices got better at their open communication with their teams on how they're performing? Because I think what you say is right. I think from a culture point of view, if you're only fed a limited amount of information as a team member, you can only judge based on that limited information. Whereas if you're exposed to more information, you might have a better understanding in terms of where that business is really at.
I think what's interesting is I think that practices are getting better. I do think that more people recognise now that there is more to it than, hiding that away in the background. I think, KPIs are a buzzword. Everybody's talking about targets. And I think that is what needs reviewing or touching base on, because I think some of those that may have been from previous kind of years need updating. But I think what is interesting for me about the success of 2020, 21, 22, because let's be honest, 2020 was an interesting year. We actually were only out of dentistry for a small amount of time. It felt like 10 years in the moment. And we all wondered what was going on. But in reality, we got back very quick. And I think we genuinely were very efficient. I know we were fallowing. I know there were gaps. And that was frustrating for dentists. But what it did was, I think it created this need to be more efficient. And so we've worked ourselves really hard and we've got really efficient. And I think that is why 21, 22 was so good, because people were better at being cost effective, efficient, using time wisely. We were squeezing patients and lots of patients in because we felt we needed to. And I think that kind of comes back to the same thing about, I harp on about diary zoning all the time, but if you can be efficient with your diaries and you can look at it as a figure, a number in your head, a target, rather than a race to how many bums on seats, that's the biggest change you can make going forward in your business. Because the moment you have that mindset change as a principal, but also that you're able to instill that in your team, that this is not about how many patients we see, but it's about how much money we make. I think that's the biggest thing, because we shy away from money chat. In general, I think, being British, we do it. Being female, we do it. Being, whatever it is, we do it a lot. And actually, I think if we can do anything, we can be better about sharing those kind of financial successes and saying, I want this.
And would you say that's a priority for 24, or is it something that's already happening?
I think if for some it's happening. I'm seeing it happen. Mm. But I also think there is a difference between seeing and doing. I think you can talk the talk and see the see. How many people actually do it? I think the other thing for dentists, and this is kind of hopefully where I come in and why I want practice managers to step up, because dentists who are running businesses who are not not businessmen. So there's a distinction. You'll meet them. You see them all the time. Mm-hmm. You'll have dentists who come in who are businessmen, and then you have dentists who come in who are dentists.
Yeah.
And it's that category that need the extra support around
them. Which is
them.
The biggest percentage.
It's the biggest percentage. Huge. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones that need help. They need that support. They need somebody to be guiding them, because what they can't do is be dentist and businessman. Mm. And they can't go to a course or go off on a CPD weekend, fill their brain with wonderful things and come back and do nothing with it.
And can't implement yet.
And because also I think it's understanding it's not their fault. They spend a minimum 5 years at dental school learning a very technical science-based thing, which from a patient point of view is amazing because we get good dentistry. But that doesn't sit well with the broad range of skills you need to be a successful business person. So it's not their fault. Mm. But I think the nature of the world, and particularly for dentists, it's a bit of a fantasy, but the reality is everybody feels that a principal somehow, from a status point of view, ranks above an associate.
Yeah,
and lots of people have an ambition to become a principal,
but
they then become...
There are some associates doing really well.
Yeah, exactly. But what you end up with is this huge cohort of reluctant principals. They never really wanted to be a business owner, but they had to, because that was kind of the next stepping stone.
They're expected to learn by osmosis, almost, isn't it? It's their factor. If I stand next to you long enough, I might catch your business knowledge. It's like,
and you know. I think the thing you talk about sliding doors, but again, I think the other thing that you have to remember is that if you think too much about dentistry and you only fill your brain with dental and dental world things, that's when you're going to leave yourself open. Because remember, in the background, we've got dentists and dentist practice owners who are running along and they're going, yep, I run a dental practice and I'm good and I do this and I you know, I tick all these boxes. That I've been on this course and they've told me to do this. And that's great. But on the other side of this, I've got an entire patient base that is also changing. So if I was to canvas that patient base and I said to them, how was 2023 for you? I guarantee you they would give us some illuminating and fascinating insight into it, because we are getting choosier as consumers. We're spending our money, and dentistry is showing us that. And now that we are moving out of that, I mean, it's taking some time, but we're moving out of the dentistry as NHS and therefore the government pays for it, et cetera, into actually, if I'm going to pay for my dentistry, I'm going to want it in a place that I feel respected and I feel like they give me good customer service and all of those things. So you're not just dealing with your own challenges in dentistry. We're dealing with the changing population in the background. You know, my kids, my eldest is 16. He's going to be a ball breaker. He's going to be the hardest person, because he will walk into somewhere and he wants something completely different to what I want.
Has the
restaurants?
Yeah. You've got about 10 years in the profession. Would you say the profession is the profession it was back then? Has it changed in those 10 years from your point of view?
Do you know, that's a great question, because yes and no. I think I've been really lucky that the practices that I've worked with have always been forward thinking, been led by great people, trying to do different things. And it's been fascinating. They've been early adopters of change and technology. And so I think the thing that I would say has changed is that is not the case anymore. There are far more up there in that level, pushing up into saying, I'm going to be better, I'm going to be greater. You know, if I take, locally to me, if I was to look across 10 practices within a 10-mile radius of me, it's going to be quite hard to choose between those 10 practices. There'll be other practices and they'll fall by the way. But there are more, I think, that are stepping up. And from a perception point of view, because I say that because it's not accurate, if I went in, I would hazard a guess. But from a perception point of view, the consumer has a huge amount of choice. But with that, when you do the smoke and mirrors, which is what creating a fancy website is, if you cannot uphold that same standard customer
if it's not genuine,
you will lose your patience. And that's what I think has changed, is there are more people who think they can show they do something and not as many who are doing the do.
More female?
I've always felt like it's been fairly female in the last 10 years. It's nice to see more female dentists coming through, obviously. But I was very fortunate that everywhere I've worked, I've always been surrounded by some incredible female characters as well. And I think
you see more female practice owners, because in our other business, we see more female practice owners.
Yeah.
One time it would be like, oh, women don't, wasn't it? You know, probably when we first started, it was be like, oh, women don't normally buy practices. But the answer is they do.
It's a big shift,
yeah. Yeah, you know what? That's probably actually a very interesting point. Yes. And I think that also is an interesting marker, because I think the way that you deal with female, you know, and I can say that, I think we're a different beast.
I was going to ask you, is there a difference? Is there a difference? Do you find... And a difference in how you communicate, but do you also find a difference in receptiveness?
Yes, I have yet to work with a female business owner who hasn't wanted to act on everything that I might say or do. And the same whenever I've worked with anybody else, there seems to be this hunger to go, I love what you're saying. Yes, let's do it. Let's implement it. Quite often, that isn't necessarily the case with a male kind of
figure. A resistance sort of.
Yeah, that's only, you know, lots of the ones that actually I work with are really up for the change.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think, again, I'm seeing a hunger to do well, but not just do well on paper.
It is, yeah, it's brilliant.
Which is great. Well, one of the things that lots of dentists are able to tell us and they kind of think is a great number is how many new patients they'd attract on a monthly basis. They're always able to give us that down to the minutest number, but they aren't particularly good at telling us about retention and how many patients they. So if it's a classic hole in the bottom of the bucket, do practices obsess about patient loyalty to the extent that they should, or do they just constantly look at new marketing techniques to bring new people in?
I think you've hit the nail on the head. I've said it for the last few months about 2024, but for me, 2024 has to be about patient loyalty. And what that means is looking at how you service your existing patient base and do you do enough for them? Like, we forget that actually, you know, I used to. So three KPIs that I would have looked at a decade ago would be new patient numbers, obsessed with them. And I would be looking at, you know, how many, what my average patient spend was for a new patient. Mm-hmm. And so what I was saying was I'm valuing new patients over other patients because they're going to spend roughly, and the number was 800 and something pounds for an average new patient spend in 2015, let's say. And I was saying, if I could get, and we were in Exeter, getting 250, 300 new patients every month, spending that kind of level on average, I was looking at that and going, that's brilliant, that's growth, that's this, that's blah, blah, blah. And I think if you are in a growth session and you are in that point, like for us, it was because we were expanding, so we had extra surgeries to fill. I think there is a time and a place for that new push.
That fits, yeah.
Exactly. But for the rest of us, what we've done is we've gone, wow, we've had a brilliant couple of years. Let's squeeze all of the dentistry we can out of this building. Let's kick our teams out of their staff rooms. Let's build extra surgeries because that's where the money gets made. And let's just drill in this, let's get high, stack them high, get lots and lots of new patients in because they spend this great money. And we've forgotten that we've got patients who are spending lots of money with us over the course of 10, hopefully, years.
Yeah, lifetime client value.
Exactly. But better still, they are the ones that are out there telling other people how fantastic you are. Now, a new patient might come in and have a wow moment and go, yeah, lovely. But a patient who's been going for however long is going to be worth their weight in gold if they tell one person every year. That might be an extra 10 patients that you've got from every single patient. And so I think patient loyalty is something that's been really undervalued in practices for quite some time. And membership plans in 2024, I've been talking about this for a little while, but I honestly believe that we should have two fee guides. There should be a members fee guide and a pay-as-you-go fee guide rather than this discount, because membership plans give a, you know, let's give
20% off, whatever 10%,
20%. But you only get that percentage if you actually need the service or you have to have the work done. So it's this negative number of something that you get that you don't really achieve any kind of benefit from as a patient, let's say.
And very true.
That is, yeah. You get 20% off your crown, but only if you need one.
Yeah,
absolutely. But supermarkets have cottoned onto this. You guys have probably been into, the town that I live in has a Sainsbury's. So I'll use a Nectar card as an example. But I went into Sainsbury's and I was buying a couple of bits. It was for one of my sons was having a few kids over. So I bought some beige food, basically crisps, pizza, you know.
Beige food.
Yeah. I got to the till. They actually said specifically, can you buy nothing green? I was like, okay.
Oh, no celery sticks then.
Yeah, sorry. And so I got to the till and I scanned this stuff through on the self-service and it came to £48. And you know, when you go, oh, okay. And then it said, have you got a Nectar card? And I went, yep, lovely. Scanned the Nectar card and it dropped to £23.
Wow.
And what they are doing now, if you notice in supermarkets, is they will put the price on the thing that says butter, £7. Yeah, right. But if you are a member of us, it's only £3 or whatever it might be. And they're all doing it. Boots are doing it.
But the interesting thing is you were like, wow, that sounds great. But if it had just ringed up at £23, you'd have just shrugged your shoulders, paid and walked out. But you actually walked out thinking, I've got a real bargain.
Absolutely. All for having a Nectar card in my wallet.
God, psychology, isn't it powerful?
Absolutely. And I think that's the problem. What we haven't been able to do is service our plan patients in the way they probably deserved for a period of time. We're struggling with fitting them in. We have struggled with fitting them in. So actually some zoning to make sure that we can fit and service all of our plan patients. But secondly, giving them something that's tangible, there's a reason to be a member and a loyal patient at the practice, I think, goes above and beyond.
It's true. When we do lectures sometimes, lectures sounds very formal. When we talk about it, we sort about the, you know, if you can work out the lifetime value of your client, then it works out how much you can spend to retain that.
Yeah.
And then we also say to people, you're all focused on getting new clients, but you realise how much it costs to get you a new client as opposed to try and keep hold of the one you got.
Do you know, it's there's a KPI around the new patients as well, because what's interesting for me is what I've been asking practices to do recently is look at that KPI number. If you are winning 50 new clients and your software tells you, so let's say you're using SOE, every month SOE tells you you've had 50 new bums on seats. What I am now saying is what I want you to do is I actually want you to track all of your inquiries. Because what I want to know is the number of patients who are inquiring with you who then don't translate into bums on seats. Because that's the disconnect. We can have all the fancy marketing. We can have all the fancy everything. We can bring thousands of patients into our, you know, our kind of domain, if you like. We can't service from that one phone call into, you know, actual conversion to chair, if you like. Then I know there's something amiss, and I want I don't need you to be spending all the money that you have on outward marketing. What you're going to need to do is spend some of that money on training.
Yeah, keeping people.
Yeah,
retention.
Absolutely.
Fix the process somewhere else. Yeah.
Because there's a difference.
Oh, TQM, that sounds like.
Yes.
But there's marketing for reputation and for that kind of perceived who you are. And then there is marketing specifically for patients. And if you don't have the capacity, the skill or the team availability as well, because that's the other thing, you know, I go into practices sometimes and they'll say, oh, I'm using all these people and I'm getting this many wonderful inquiries. And then I say to them, okay, so your front of house team's made up of, and they go, yeah, one person. I'm like, right.
And when a new patient rings up, they put you on hold.
Yeah, don't.
It is mad, isn't it? Yeah. We sit there as consumers and we go, oh, this is terrible, but they just don't get it. No, it's brilliant. Actually, it's good. It's good.
Yeah.
Lucy, it's been wonderful. I can't believe we've been talking for over 50 minutes. It's
sorry.
No, not at all. Not at all. No, it's
not
been
a boring moment in there.
No. But we have got to the point. We have got to the point where we need to ask you two questions.
Yes.
Dun, dun, dun.
So the first question we have for you is, if you could be the fly on a wall in a situation, where would that be and who'd be there?
I'm intrigued with this because it's a non-dentist.
Yeah, so this is going to be my guilty pleasure. Ooh. So please don't judge me on this, you all listeners, but I have been absolutely roped into, pulled into the Colleen Rooney Vardy, Rebecca Vardy.
Oh, okay.
So is this the journalism in you coming back?
I think it is, because I want to be the fly on the wall when Rebecca Vardy and her agent decided that phone needed to go.
I was going to say, to drop it in the water by mistake, yeah. Oh!
Did they play the Titanic theme tune and do the whole... they were doing it. Yeah, that moment.
Who was Leo and who was Kate?
Absolutely. That's what I want to know. So that would be the time and the place and the when and the who.
Well, that's unique. We never had that one before. No, that is unique. Thank you. Yeah,
that's a great one. And if you could meet somebody, who would you like to meet given the opportunity?
Do you know that I've thought about this one, and I could go round the houses all day long with amazing female, powerful, incredible, you know, I could do the Michelle Obama, I could do this, I could do that, all wonderful people. I would want to go back and I would like to have dinner with Kate Adie. So if she's listening, just by any kind of weird link, I'm happy to take out dinner. I'll come to you. I would just love to fill in the blanks of the stuff that's gone on for her from that, see what she thinks about what's gone on in journalism and how it's changed, and obviously what's happened after her, because I'm sure she does on some level know that a lot of it is her.
I'll send her a text.
Yeah, cool. If you wouldn't mind. But it would be her. I'd like to have dinner with her again, and I'd like to just say thank you.
You should tag her in the LinkedIn or the Instagram post, because you never know so much. You might look at it.
You never know.
That'd be great, wouldn't it? Can you imagine that? Part two. I had dinner with Kate Adie.
It's a lovely bookended episode, isn't it? Because we started about how influential she was in your career and giving you that real passion and energy for journalism. Yeah. And so to have that towards the end is lovely. And why not?
Well, I'll tell you, but imagine that would be great. We should do it, because at least there's a genuine reason for doing it, not like we just picked on someone out around.
Absolutely, yeah. Hey, Michelle Obama.
Why have they paid? I think we should give it a go, see what happens.
Why not?
You have to tell us. You have to tell us if by any chance, absolutely, remotely as it might be.
I'll record all of it.
Can you imagine that? That would be a great one.
Lucy, it's been wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It's been
great. And I think you've got great insights into dentistry from a non-clinical point of view, and I would expect people listening to this will be able to either reach out to you for help from you, or just think about how they operate and tweak what they do, because a lot of it's within their reach. Yeah, it's not reinventing the wheel, it's just kind of tweaking what they're doing and thinking about it.
I was gonna say, I do presume you travel.
I do. I will go anywhere and everywhere. I particularly like hot, sunny climates.
Lytham St. Anne's then.
Yeah. Absolutely. I do. And I also currently am running Ashley Latter's Practice Manager Club. So that's a fantastic kind of entry for practice managers to come in and spend a bit of time with me, which is fabulous and definitely something I'm very proud of being part of.
If you could perhaps let us have a couple of links for things so that people can easily find you. We can drop those into the guest notes so people can just click directly through, which would be cool.
Yeah, brilliant.
Lucy, thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Appreciate your time today. It's been great.
Thanks so much.
No problem at all. Look after yourself.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dentology, where we discuss the business of dentistry. If you like what you heard, please do subscribe where you found this episode. That would be amazing. And also follow us on Instagram.